The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called The Four Messengers and the Message, taught by John Yaffe and Bridget Rollins. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. John Yaffe began practicing insight meditation in 1999 and has been a co-leader of St. Louis Insight Meditation Group since 2006. John is a student of Matthew Flickstein and has served on the Mid-America Dharma Board of Directors since 2005. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Her mentors include Matthew Flickstein, Ginny Morgan, and Gloria Terania Ambrosia. Recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, Bridget shares the Dharma through classes, workshops, and retreats.
So I just kind of like to set the stage for our retreat. Again, the title of the retreat, the theme of the retreat are the four messengers and the message. And we'll be unfolding this as we go along. You know, there is this legend that is within Buddhism that goes about 2,600 years ago. The Buddha to be was born into the human realm as the son of a king in northern India. And this prince lived a very sheltered life, protected from all the unpleasantness of human life by his father. But as young people will do, they escape, and he got outside the palace walls one day. And encountered a person who was old, a person who was sick, a corpse, and a renunciate. Renunciate is one who has let go, left all possessions, status, power, and is a spiritual seeker looking for the truth and a true and lasting happiness. So, encountering someone who was old and decrepit, teeth missing, hair gray, bent over, someone who was sick, and in the description in the legend, I guess the sick person had purple blotches, and I mean, it was really looked yucky. And then a corpse. You might say the Buddha had a rude awakening, and awakening is what this is all about. But for him, it was kind of pulling the rug out from under him. And for the first time, he had to confront the fact that this was not just for other people. This was something that happens to all human beings, including himself. And he was coming face to face with the reality that his youth, his health, and his life were all impermanent. That all of that is subject to change. It's unstable. It was not something he could have any control over. You know, we can have a little bit of control over the state of our health by taking care of these bodies. You know, we can, again, care for this human body and still be vibrant as the years advance. But still, no matter how well we're taking care of ourselves, at some point we're going to get sick. We are going to age, and the body is going to lose its vitality, and we are going to die. So, having this thrown in his face, he remembered the fourth messenger that he saw. It was this renunciate who didn't have anything, but seemed so calm and peaceful. His face was radiant. And he thought, that person isn't bothered by aging, illness, and death. I want what he has. And so he left the palace, left a wife and kid, left his possessions, all his wealth, his power, his status, and took on the life of a renunciate. And I'd like to let the Buddha use his words. Now, he doesn't talk about the three messengers, but this is his experience. He said, "I lived in refinement, utmost refinement, total refinement. My father even had lotus ponds made in our palace, one where red lotuses bloomed, one where white lotuses bloomed, one where blue lotuses bloomed, all for my sake. I used no sandalwood that was not from Varanasi. My turban was from Varanasi, as were my tunic, my lower garments, and my outer cloak. I take it Varanasi was, you know, like, I don't know, the Nordstrom's or... A white sunshade was held over me day and night to protect me from cold, heat, dust, dirt, and dew. I had three palaces, one for the hot season, one for the rainy season, one for the cold season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained in the rainy season palace by minstrels without a single man among them." He must have liked the ladies. "And I did not once come down from the palace. Whereas the servants, workers, and retainers of other people's homes are fed meals of lentil soup and broken rice, in my father's home, the servants, workers, and retainers were fed wheat, rice, and meat." So, I mean, you know, even my servants live better than everybody else. "Then, even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me. When an untaught, run-of-the-mill person, himself subject to aging, not beyond aging, sees another who is aged, he is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious to himself that he too is subject to aging, not beyond aging. If I, Prince Siddhartha, who am subject to aging, not beyond aging, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who is aged, that would not be fitting for me. As I notice this, the typical young person's intoxication with youth entirely dropped away. Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me." And you might notice this is repeating, except we change one word. Joseph Goldstein said often when we're reading the discourses of the Buddha and it just repeats the same thing over and over, it's like you just want to kind of skip through to the end. And I had this urge to just condense it. But Joseph said, you know, if he keeps repeating something, it must be really important. So we will repeat, just in case you didn't get it the first time, and you will have a third chance. "Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person herself, subject to illness, not beyond illness, sees another who is ill, she is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious to herself that she too is subject to illness. And if I, who am subject to illness, not beyond illness, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who is ill, that would not be fitting for me. As I notice this," and we might say, the Buddha was saying, as I contemplated this, as I really thought about this, as I really let myself connect with this, the healthy person's intoxication with health entirely dropped away. "Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me. When an untaught, run-of-the-mill person himself, subject to death, not beyond death, sees another who is dead, he or she is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious that they too are subject to death, not beyond death. And if I, who am subject to death, not beyond death, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who is dead, that would not be fitting for me. As I notice this, the living person's intoxication with life entirely dropped away. So as the Buddha really let himself connect with the reality and get it, just like everyone else I can observe, I am going to get sick, I am going to age, get old, and I am going to die. He noticed that before that, that there was this intoxication with youth, with health, and with life. And you know, when we are intoxicated, we become oblivious, unaware. We don't see things correctly. We become oblivious to our surroundings, our bodies, other people, our morals. There is a Pali word, and Pali, for those of you who might be new to this, is the language that the Buddha taught in, and the first teachings of the Buddha were written down. There is a word, and it's called pamada, P-A-M-A-D-A. It means heedlessness or inattention. And it's one of the places that it's used is in one of the precepts that, and I'll talk about precepts in a little bit, but a precept that says that we want to refrain from taking intoxicants that cause heedlessness. So we can be intoxicated with the ideas or the illusion of youth, of health, and of life. And what this is doing is it's preventing us from seeing things as they really are. We are heedless of realities of sickness, aging, and death. And when we're heedless, we're less likely to make wise decisions or act wisely in our lives. So if I'm intoxicated and, you know, just kind of focusing and striving for, and my whole life is around staying young, you know, never getting sick, not dying. There's nothing wrong with caring for this body to the best that we can, but it's the intoxication. I won't be making probably wise decisions or acting wisely. The Buddha ended this discourse with a song of liberation, a poetic utterance. He said, "Subject to birth, subject to aging, subject to death, run-of-the-mill people are repelled by those who suffer from that to which they are subject. And if I were to be repelled by being subject to these things, it would not be fitting for me, living as they do. As I maintained this attitude, knowing the Dharma without acquisitions, I overcame all intoxication with health, youth, and life, as one who sees renunciation as rest. I maintain this attitude, knowing the Dhamma without acquisitions." Without acquisitions, statement of renunciation. Renunciation isn't deprivation, it isn't punishment, it isn't flagellation. It isn't depriving ourselves of every pleasurable thing in the world. However, renunciation is letting go. And when we can let go of acquisition, of acquiring, more possessions, more status, more power, our energies can be turned onto pursuit of what is true, onto pursuit of what actually will bring happiness. And so the Buddha was one who could see renunciation as rest. You know, the opposite of renunciation is acquisition. Get another title, get another job, get another car, get another this, get another that, get a little more power here. Oh, it's exhausting. You know, we're all stressed out from trying to get. Make sure we've got enough. Letting go. It's a place of rest. And he said, for me, energy arose. Unbinding was clearly seen. So on this retreat, actually, we're all becoming temporary renunciates. So stop and just think for a moment. You're letting go of your usual preoccupations as householders. You're not at home. You're here. You're letting go of your usual distractions. You know, we're asking you, don't listen to the radio, don't turn on a TV, don't put headphones on. We even said, don't read, even a Dharma book. Not because there's anything wrong with reading a Dharma book, but because that could be a distraction that helps us get into our heads and escape what's actually happening right here and now. And what's happening right here and now, that's our teacher. What's happening in your mind and your body, that's your teacher. And we're letting go of everything else, and we're engaging in all these different practices, formal and informal, to help kind of create a container so that we can just keep coming back to right here, right now. And let our experience teach us. This is the way of the Buddha. You know, the Buddha did go to teachers, and he got a lot of good stuff from his teachers, some good foundation. But when push came to shove, the way he found the way to freedom was he just looked very deeply at what's going on in this mind and body. And he awakened to what the truth is. So, you know, we're not going to be acquiring any position, status, or power on this retreat. There might be an acquiring of wisdom, and that's a very skillful thing to acquire. We would even ask you, if possible, now it might not be possible, you may have people at home, but if possible, continue the container of the retreat at home. Continue to be the renunciate. And don't turn on the TV. Don't get out on the internet. Don't pull out the video game. Continue your practice. I did make copies of 3 suttas. One of them is the one that I just talked, Discourses of the Buddha. They're on the table there. Please feel free to take those with you. And that would be a skillful thing to read, just to help you kind of get your mind into the teaching of the Buddha. However, if you notice that you're going to read those because you're wanting to avoid being with what actually is, put down the paper. Now, I understand that there are people at various levels of practice on the retreat. So some of you might be long-term students of the Dharma. I'm pretty sure there are a number of you who are in John's Committed Practice class. And this retreat is kind of like intensive Committed Practice class, because this is what you're practicing and studying together. So you'll be revisiting contemplations that you've been touching into, and you'll just notice the mind that says, oh, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, why don't they say something new? Well, we can just say the same thing over and over in terms of what the truth is, but every time we can go a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper into it. Or you might be like the Star Trek crew of the Enterprise, you know, going where you have never gone before, into unknown territory. Let's just appreciate the fact that what we're doing is countercultural. Okay. When was the last time, you know, you saw a big glossy ad that said, go to your local hospital and visit people who are really ill and contemplate the reality that you too are going to get sick and find the most awful, horrendous, oozing sick person you can find and sit in their room and contemplate that. Or perhaps on the radio you heard, if you want to be happy, go to the nursing home in your town and see what old age looks like, smells like, sounds like, and contemplate the reality that you too are going to get old. You know, or is there, you know, the talk show talking about going to a morgue and sitting with dead bodies before they're all prettied up and contemplating the reality that someday your body will be lying on a gurney lifeless. Now, at this point, some of you may be saying, this is not the retreat for me. I think I'm going home. What did I get myself into? I mean, so I would like us to honor the fact that, you know, the topic that John and I chose can be very challenging. Okay? If you find that there's a part of you kind of going, you know, wanting to pull back, feeling some resistance, maybe feeling some anxiety, please know that there's nothing wrong with you. Please know that you can get through this retreat. Well, we will have all kinds of supports for doing this. Don't be alarmed. Don't judge yourself. You know, this, if you're feeling any pushback or any nervousness now that I've gone through all of this about really practicing with this, just appreciate that you have come to an edge of your practice. Our teacher, Matt Flickstein, was always talking about the edge of practice. And I forget, John, do you remember? I think he said, whenever you're at the edge of the practice, you're probably experiencing some grief and fear. You know, grief at what you're leaving behind, fear about the unknown that you're about to move into. So, you know, we all have our comfort zone in practice. You know, it might be that staying with the breath, we found some stability and we found some peacefulness. And that's our comfort zone. There may be different parts of the Dharma that we don't, you know, that we've really come to accept, you know, and it's like, yeah, it was difficult at first to touch into it, but, you know, I'm just really comfortable with this now. This may take you to the edge of your comfort zone. I would invite you, first of all, to be very compassionate and kind and gentle with yourself. Okay? So don't force or push. But I would also invite you, push a little bit in past your comfort zone. Let yourself engage where it's not comfortable for you. You know, where there's resistance, where there's pushback, where there's anxiety about this. You know, let yourself touch into it. But then also, you know, if it gets too much, step back. And if you're overwhelmed or if it gets too much, you can always come back to your breath. Okay? Breath is home base. And as you come back to your breath, you might want to use skillful thought, some wise thought, which would be to focus right in the here and now and focus on the Dharma, the truth that you are alive and you're in good enough health to be on this retreat no matter what age you are. Okay, so Rick Hansen talks about a little meditation, noticing you're all right now. Can everybody in this room say, right in the present moment, I have enough food, clothing, shelter, and access to medical care? There are hospitals here who cannot turn you away because they take Medicare and they can't turn you away. Okay. So right now, we're all right. Okay. There may be, you know, in those moments when you think, oh, too much, you know, and your mind is just swirling maybe with thoughts about illness, aging, death, the emotions might be coming up. Just imagine that they're all visitors to the room of your mind, okay? And you've got a background and a foreground in your mind. Let all of them recede into the background and put your breath in the foreground, okay? Put your body in the foreground. Because as John so well put in the meditation instructions, our bodies can only exist in the here and now. And even if you do have aches and pains or a cold or something going on, for the most part, your body functioned enough to get you here. So don't try and resist and push away and make yourself stop thinking or feeling so that you can go back to your breath. You know, it's just like, here they all are, and here you are, and you got caught in the turmoil of them. But what you're going to do is you're not going to fight and push and try and get them out. What you're going to do is you're just going to turn away and turn to the breath. Okay? So coming back. And if you find it helpful, as you breathe in, you might say, I'm all right, as you breathe out right now. Feel the letting go, the relaxation of the exhale. Let it help your body to let go and relax. And just for a few breaths, you might remind, I'm all right, right now. I'm all right, right now. And then let go of the phrases. They're skillful thought. But what you really want to do then is go back to just focusing on the breath. Okay? So you've got a home base. You've got a safe place to go to. And then when and this is concentration practice, and it can create stability, it can create calm, it can create some peace. You know, and you can't really investigate or explore without some semblance of that stability. So it's skillful to do that. And then when you feel a little more stable, you know, just kind of peek out, take a few steps back into that unknown territory and continue your exploration. And remember, John and I are here if you run into difficulty. So please, you know, if you're having difficulty, we would love to support you. Grab us during a walking meditation. And, you know, we can talk about whatever's going on. Okay. Any questions? No? All right. Yes. Oh, I am not a scholar commentator, so I can only tell you what I think he meant. Okay. I think what he said, when he said it's not fitting, I hear that as, that wasn't really helpful. You know, to do it that way does not bring me freedom. That doesn't help me find the way to a happiness that is not conditioned. How would you answer that, John? Anything else? And really, quite frankly, most of the practice is going to be on the four foundations of mindfulness. So most of the practice will start tomorrow with the first foundation, focusing on body, as a way of building concentration and then using body to develop insight. So, yeah, so I probably, probably painted maybe a more challenging picture than this retreat's actually going to be. Well, and if you know John, he can take the dark and make it very humorous. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So at the beginning of a retreat, in the tradition in which we practice, it is customary to have a little ritual called taking the refuges and the precepts. So going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You know, when I think of refuge, sometimes what I think of is like, you know, a port in the storm. And life can get so stormy, can't it? And don't you wish it was just a safe port you could go into, you're sheltered, the storm's out there, but it can't get to you. And so when people would hear the Buddha and say, this guy has what I want, and you know what? I want to be his student. You know, I want to follow this guy. One of the first things they would do is take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So taking refuge in the Buddha, we can understand this as, oh, thank God there was a human being just like me who experienced all the things I experienced, and he was able to say, guess what? I have found freedom from suffering, and here's the way I did it. I'm so glad the Buddha, you know, appeared on the earth. And so we can take refuge in the historic person of the Buddha and the fact that he awakened. We can also understand Buddha as our potential for awakening. Each one of us is a Buddha in the making. We just haven't fully realized our true nature. So the Buddha can also be potential for awakening. And we can take refuge in, you know what? I'm confused right now, but it is possible to wake up. The Dharma, in one sense with the big D, we can see that as the teachings the Buddha passed down. And I am just so grateful to be living in an age when I can go on to the internet, type in some words, and I got 3 suttas that I could download and share with my Dharma friends here. I mean, there's just such an abundance. There, the access to really good teachers is often just, you know, a few keystrokes away. And look at this. We have, what, 27, 28 people on a retreat, you know, and we're teaching one another. You know, John and I are just passing on. It's kind of like we're channeling all the teachers that we ever encountered. So it's just, you know, the teachings and the actual words attributed to the Buddha that are probably pretty close to what he was teaching are available to us. And there's so much wonderful wisdom there. There's also Dhamma with a small d, and that's the truth of the way things are. And, you know, the Buddha was all about discovering the truth of the way things are. That was the first Dhamma. And then he talked about it, and that was Dhamma with a big D. So we can take refuge in these teachings, but we can also take refuge in whatever is happening in this moment. And we're being given the tools to be with it in a way that we can see it clearly. We can see how suffering is getting created. We can also see how suffering can be eliminated, can be decreased. And then there is Sangha. And one way to understand Sangha, and that might be with a big S, it's what we call the noble ones, and it refers to the monastic community who have faithfully passed the teachings down. I mean, in the very beginning, they memorized everything the Buddha said, and they would keep reciting it over and over and over, and they get together and recite it and make sure, you know, they were all reciting the same thing. And the monastics have devoted their whole lives to embodying, practicing, studying, and passing on the Dharma. So that's one understanding of Sangha. There is also the understanding of Sangha that anyone who is following the path of the Buddha is a noble one. And that's all of us here. So here we have Sangha. You know, I met someone, I used to live in St. Louis. It's so good to be back with all of you, all of my friends from St. Louis. And someone was saying, well, you know what? That just left my head completely. do you remember what you said, Nanette? Aging. The truth of aging. So anyway, Sangha. You know, we have Sangha here. We have, what Nanette said, she found a Kalyanamita group, a spiritual friends group, and was so happy to find that. And she said, it's really hard to do this alone. You know, if you're doing this alone, I hope we can connect you with spiritual companions. Because it is hard to do this alone. You know, as I said, where are you going to see in modern society encouraging you to contemplate sickness, aging, and death, to really let yourself learn from it? So we have the Sangha support, and right now this is what Sangha looks like. So we can take refuge in that. You know, we're creating a container. We're all creating this container that we can come, and it's like we can, you know, kind of, we know we're safe. Joe is, you know, kind of keeping watch there. John and I are keeping watch. So you can just kind of relax and feel safe. So this is Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And we can take refuge in what is sometimes called the triple gem. Then for the retreat, we take the precepts. In fact, on your registration, there was a little thing about, are you willing to undertake the precepts while you're on this retreat? And you had to say yes before we could let you in. Now, just in case, I wonder if if people do like we do with licenses and things, you know, say, read the whole document. I never read it. So if you didn't read the precepts and you checked yes, well, you're caught now. But the precepts, there are many ways that the Buddha approached. One of the main areas of the path to liberation, and that was to look at our ethical conduct, to look at morality. Because, you know, as one teacher said, if you're pillaging and raping, it's going to be real hard for your mind to calm down. And it doesn't even have to be that bad, you know, if you're kind of lying and cheating and talking ill about other people, you know, or, you know, getting drunk all the time or that kind of thing. It's really hard to have a clear mind. So, one way of speaking of morality are the five precepts. And so we undertake the practice to refrain from taking life. So that means that, and here's the thing, taking the precepts is a wonderful gift because you've taken the precept and now you know nobody in this room is going to kill you. And really, we can take it beyond that and say, even harm in any way. So we're refraining as much as we can from any harmful action. we take a precept of refraining from taking that which is not given. So, you know, no one's going to be taking my cushion or my keys or my wallet in here. It's not been given. So, again, that creates a place of safety. Also, if you're not stealing, you'll have a clearer mind. There is undertaking the precept to refrain from unwise speech. We're practicing noble silence, so it's real hard to speak unwisely when you're not talking. And in life in general, we want to watch that our speech is true, that it's helpful, that it's kind, that it's timely. And as one person said, before you speak, ask if it will improve upon silence. But using our speech in ways that are kind, in ways that do not harm. So that's another. And then we undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct. Now, if you were on another retreat, you would be invited to refrain from any kind of sexual activity, but we'll just stay with sexual misconduct. So, you know, using your sexuality in a way that harms either you or the other person. And then the fifth is refraining from taking intoxicants that cause heedlessness. Again, it's not so much the substance, it's the effect. So this could be some kind of substance, but, you know, do we induce intoxication by hours and hours of video games, computer games, or by hours and hours of TV, or hours and hours of some kind of gambling or going out shopping? I mean, there's lots of intoxicants, but the problem is that it causes heedlessness. We're not aware. And what we're not aware of, we can't really do anything about. This retreat, any retreat, the practice is about waking up, being really aware, seeing clearly. And we can't do that if we're intoxicated. So we take these refuges and precepts. And there's a little chant that we can do with this. So at this point, I'm going to turn the recorder off.